This is the Send Talks podcast from Galdards.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to our podcast about refusal to assess. I'm here with Adam.
Hi, everyone.
And today we're going to be discussing the refusal to assess case and appeal to the SEND tribunal. So what do you do when you have made your application, you've listened to our previous podcast and you sent in your letter and your form and you set everything out very clearly in all of the sections that we described, you know, cognition and learning, communication, interaction, sensory and physical and social and emotional mental health needs, and you get a no. So the first thing that we would advise you doing is to diarise your deadline. Your deadline to appeal is 2 months from the date of that letter. Now, that letter needs to provide you with reasoning as to why the application has been refused, first and foremost. Now, if I just explain the deadline issue and then we'll go on to the reasoning after. So 2 months from the date of that letter, and there will be the details of a mediation service on that letter as well. Now, usually Adam and I don't advise mediation, do we, Adam?
Very rarely. The first thing to say is you have to call up that mediation service and obtain a mediation certificate before you appeal to the SEND tribunal. Doesn't mean that you have to enter into mediation. In fact, as Salisse was saying, it's very rare in these types of cases that we would. But you still have to call up the mediation service, allow them to tell you about the wonders of mediation before you obtain a mediation certificate. The mediation certificate itself holds a 1 month right of appeal from when they issue it. The tribunal will treat the latest possible date of appeal as the latest possible date from either the original decision letter or the mediation certificate, whichever is latest. So you either have a 2 month right of appeal or you could have potentially up to almost 3 months depending on when you get your mediation certificate.
Yeah, and that's if you need some more time as well. You can time it that way. I mean, mediation, it's usually quite an unfair negotiation. Mediation, it usually just elongates the time to get to appeal, and the appeal deadlines or the time that these appeals are taking in tribunal at the moment are quite long due to the sheer number of tribunal appeals that the tribunal are receiving at the moment. You know, we have quarterly meetings with the judges and the SEND panel who are running the admin team, etc. And the number of appeals are unprecedented at the moment, aren't they?
They are. I think it's the understanding of the purpose of mediation. So I always find that mediation is at the wrong stage of the appeal process. I think they would be really useful later on when parents have had the opportunity to obtain their own evidence to maybe look at mediation maybe a month before your final hearing.
Yeah.
And in fact, in a lot of jurisdictions, that's how it works. But with the SEND tribunal, mediation is at the beginning of the process. In a needs assessment case where local authorities refuse to undertake a needs assessment, you're looking at that legal test of whether it may be necessary. Usually the local authority have refused that on the basis of the information that parents have put towards the panel. So even if their decisions are wrong, it's very rare at that stage that the local authority will suddenly change its position. So in that situation, you tend to turn up to mediation. Local authority has to have a case officer senior enough that they know what they're doing to turn up to those meetings and potentially negotiate and agree to the needs assessment.
Yeah.
The issue is mediation is done under a window of without prejudice, which means that anything discussed at those mediations cannot be used in tribunal proceedings. So the problem is we tend to find a lot of local authorities don't really take the mediation very seriously. So they could come to those meetings, tell you everything they would like to, why they don't need to undertake the needs assessment, and there's not really much you can do with that information. In a lot of cases, in terms of resolutions, very rarely do I see ones where the authorities suddenly change its position. Usually it will agree to put into place more provision, maybe have one of their experts come in and assess a child. But if you need to do all of those things, that really fits in with the test of whether it may be necessary to undertake a needs assessment. So if the authorities agree to that, really it should be agreeing to undertake the needs assessment anyway.
Yeah, I agree, which is why, personally say to my clients, you know, we always negotiate and we always try and mediate with the local authority in the life of the appeal anyway. It's just a time saving exercise if you're doing it during the appeal. I think it's just like Adam said, kicking the can down the line if not. So those are the deadlines. If you go back to reasons for refusal to assess, we discussed a little bit before in our previous podcast about the application process itself. But usual suspects tend to be there's not enough information. Your child isn't 2 years or more behind their peers. They are receiving the help that they should be receiving, and we think that they are progressing in line with their peers when really, you know, you're putting into place, you know, 5 hours of tuition, you know, an hour of tuition after school every day, etc., and they're not taking account of all of that support that's propping them up and helping them. Those are kind of the reasons that we tend to get.
If you get proper reasons, a lot of these letters are very vague about the reasons for refusing to undertake the needs assessment. The first thing I would say to any parent is, usually when a local authority refuses to undertake a needs assessment, it's because it hasn't considered the application properly. The reasons that
usually... numbers game, isn't it, usually?
It is. I mean, the problem is the, I suppose if you said yes to every EHC needs assessment which came through, that would probably lead to a lot of EHC plans, which is a lot of expense to the authorities. So we tend to find that local authorities turn down a lot of needs assessment applications. Most of the ones that we assist with were wrongly turned down. Yeah. And if you look at tribunal figures for refusal to assess cases, a lot of local authorities will concede or be ordered to undertake the needs assessment by the tribunal itself.
Yeah, it's a very low threshold, and we're going to go on to that in a minute, because, you know, as Adam said, if there's 50 applications a year, you refuse 40 of them and only 10 of those 40 appeal, then you've saved money on 30. So sometimes no one's actually had a look at it, and we need to appeal to get someone to actually look at the papers. But the threshold is actually really low, and it's for none of those reasons. It's not just the local authority's discretion. There is actually legislation that's written down, and that the tribunal and the local authority should be following in order to make that decision. So it's a two-stage threshold, and the first is that the child has or may have SEN. Now, I draw your attention to the word may. That's potentially. I think it's more likely than not. And the second stage is that it's an and in between. So that the child or young person has or may have SEN, and it is necessary for special educational provision. For special educational provision to be put in place in line with an education healthcare plan. Now, what does that mean? What does that last bit mean?
Well, I think the first thing to say is we take a step back. Usually in a case where a parent has made an application for an EHC needs assessment, or a parent and school have, or a school have done it on behalf of parents, it's usually because there is an identified need, or people are pretty clear that there's a difficulty which needs to be fully understood. Usually by that stage of making that application, quite a lot of provision has already been put into place, either independently by parents or by school and nurseries themselves. So usually there is sufficient information for local authorities to undertake the needs assessment. So what you tend to find is internal policy getting in the way of the requirements to do the local authority's legal duty. So internal policy might be, and we've referred to it previously, that a school must do two cycles of SEN provision internally before it makes an application for a needs assessment.
And just by the way, for anyone listening to this, if anyone sees a written policy like that, please send it to us, because it is massively unlawful. Yeah. We would love to challenge it.
And, you know, the other one is we don't consider independent evidence. So the local authority might say, well, you might have a speech and language therapist report yourself or an occupational therapist report, but we don't consider those reports. We only consider statutory reports, so reports from our own services.
Yeah.
Now, I think the thing to remember here also is the local authority might say to you, well, the child's needs are being met within the classroom. If you are propping up what's happening at school by putting into place a lot of independent provision, so therapies or specialist teaching outside of school, those are all things which indicate that the provision within the school is not adequate at meeting your child's needs. It might also be the case that your school is already providing provision way even above that they should be at this stage.
Yeah.
The usual conversations I have with parents is they've been informed by schools that there is no more resource that they can provide, or in some cases, which is quite worrying, schools have had to reach out to parents and ask them to fund provision within those schools,
yeah,
like learning support assistance.
Yeah.
All of those things, if a decision is not to undertake the needs assessment and you've got all that stuff in place, for me, those would be key points which I would indicate to me that a child needs a needs assessment and probably needs an EHC plan.
A needs assessment at the very least in situations like that.
But to say, it may not be even that clear. It might be that your child is really struggling to go to school.
Yeah.
Can't really understand why that your child can't go to school.
Yeah, high anxiety.
Exactly. They may not be attending, but your school might say, well, academically, they're brilliant, and we don't really understand why not. And local authority might have turned to you and said, we're not undertaking the needs assessment because your child is academically doing very well.
Yeah.
Despite the fact they haven't been in school for half a term.
Exactly.
All of those aspects would again indicate the need for a needs assessment, because a child is not just their core subjects. When you're looking at progress, you're looking at progress in cognitive and learning, communication, interaction, social, emotional, mental health, as well as physical and sensory, and also life and independence. And those are just general headlines in terms of areas of need, but it could be other areas that we haven't even kind of identified. When Parliament came up with the Children and Families Act and also the same code of practice, the idea was to ensure that children did not go without the provision necessary to meet their needs. It was to ensure that they got their provision as quickly as possible to ensure that they could achieve the best possible outcome in their education. So if any of this is resonating to a listener, any of these key factors, that should be telling you, well, actually, I'm not sure. I don't think the local authority's decision not to undertake an EHC needs assessment was correct.
Yeah, go for the appeal. In terms of the legislation, sometimes it can be quite unclear. So it's special educational provision in line with an education healthcare plan may be necessary. If you kind of take a step back, because lawyers love to define like an onion or one of those babushka dolls, like what's this mean, what does this mean, and what does that mean? So what is defined as special educational provision, SEP? It is anything that is additional to or different from that provided to other children or young people of the same age. So if my daughter does need a one-to-one, or if my son does need regular movement breaks or some, a touch typing course or any kind of provision, really, that's different to anybody else in the rest of his class, or generally, in classrooms across England. So that's what it's defined as, really. What in addition to everybody else does your child need or might need? Because that isn't it? It's potentially.
Yeah, and I think an important kind of, I suppose, checkbook against that is have a look at your school SEND policy. Look at where your child is in terms of the SEND policy and where they are in terms of the levelling up of provision. Look at where you as a parent are already putting into place provision over and above that. It may be provided independently, or you might be going to your local NHS services and being receiving a high level of speech and language and occupational therapy through those services in addition to what's happening at school. All of that gives an indication about whether a child's needs can be realistically met within a mainstream school without an EHC plan. The legal test of may be necessary, as we've discussed previously, is a low threshold.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a balance of 50-50.
Yeah.
So if on kind of looking at all those aspects, your conclusion is, no, my school cannot meet my child's needs within their own resources, generally available in all mainstream schools, I suppose, then really the local authority should be undertaking a needs assessment.
Yeah. I mean, to give you guys an idea of just how low that threshold is, when I worked for local authority for 4 years, in my 4 years, I took two cases to appeal for a refusal to an assess. One of them I conceded halfway through the hearing because the evidence that came out from the teacher at the school meant that I changed my advice during that hearing, took instructions and conceded halfway through because the evidence changed in my opinion. And the second one, we opposed because the child or young person in question had health needs, in our opinion, not education needs, and they had a very detailed healthcare plan. But we still lost that because the local authorities, because the tribunal said, well, they may have educational needs despite this. I think it was diabetes that they had. They had type 1 diabetes, but everything else was fine. Very young child. But we lost that, and that's in four and a half years. So the fact that sometimes we get these through to us, and they have increased, haven't they, Adam? I feel like they've increased.
They are, and the reasons are getting worse.
They are.
I've had ones
more and more imaginative.
Yeah, I've had ones which basically have said this child is making progress at the school, so therefore we don't believe it's necessary to undertake a needs assessment. The school in question has been an independent special school which a parent within their own resources is funding, and obviously no mainstream school can provide that level of provision.
Yeah.
So it's an important thing for parents to understand that if you are, say, in an independent environment and you've placed your child there because you're concerned about their needs, that doesn't kind of exclude you from the needs assessment process and having an EHC plan. Independent placements, when we get to an EHC plan, and we'll talk about that in later podcasts, yeah, can be named in the plan as well.
Yeah.
In fact, for me, if you're putting into place, you know, smaller classes, a higher level of specialist teaching and therapy on top of that, that's a very good indication that a child needs a EHC needs assessment.
Spending barely any time in the classroom.
Exactly.
Quality first teaching. Oh, that one gets me every time. Yeah. We think that Johnny's needs can be met via quality first teaching. What? Like, sometimes I stare at the letters. I'm like, what?
It's really frustrating because what does quality first teaching really mean? And also when you, I suppose, qualify to be a teacher, You do not get the kind of level of what we think training you need to understand special educational needs and address them in the classroom.
Yeah.
Usually the first time you really understand a child's needs is when you come across it in your classroom. And, you know, sometimes schools can respond to that really well with new teachers. Other times those teachers may have their own misunderstanding of need and how you address it.
Yeah.
So all of those aspects should be things that parents should be thinking about. The other thing to say is when you get your decision, the key thing that a lot of parents might think is, oh, I'll go and talk to the local authority about this, or I'll go and talk to my school about this. With local authorities, it's very rare that they'll overturn their decision without having an appeal against them. With schools, often schools maybe incorrectly will accept the local authorities' decision, because often those schools have been trained by local authorities themselves.
Yeah.
And when local authorities train up local authorities, it's in line with their policy rather than on the basis of the legal test and also the code of practice.
Yeah.
So when you're getting that decision, if you've spoken to your local authority and they won't change their position, or you've spoken to your school and your school has said, well, we've done everything we can, we'll just accept the authority's decision, that doesn't mean that you have to. Often, as I say, when parents appeal to the SEND tribunal, those decisions are overturned. Often, when needs assessments are turned down by a local authority, it's either under misunderstanding of need or on policy. It's not really on the basis of the law.
Yeah.
So if you're concerned about a decision that a local authority has made where they refuse to undertake a needs assessment, don't just accept it. Go and seek some advice. Go and see if the decision has actually been properly made.
Yeah, knowledge is power. Okay, so the appeal process. Now, in episodes 5 and 7 from season 1, we do go through it in a lot more detail. We thought it'd be a good idea to explain to you guys the appeals process for a refusal to assess process now. So the first thing you do is line with your deadline that we've explained at the beginning. You lodge your application. So there's an appeal form, you lodge grounds of appeal. You need to include your letter from the local authority giving you your right of appeal, and any documents that you think is relevant. So any recent reports that you've undertaken, hopefully a supporting letter from the school, although we don't always get that. Any kind of medical documents.
Any kind of SEN plans that you have in place.
Yes, so individual learning plans there are usually, or any kind of support reports, school reports that we've got from the school, and you send that into the SEND tribunal. The details of how to do that is on the appeal form. It will take some time at the moment. Adam and our paralegals at the office are, one of their topics of discussion is the latest timetables that's been given to them for registering an appeal. We're recording this in October, kind of mid to late October, and at the moment registration is taking about 25 working days before, about a year ago, maybe a little bit longer now even, It should have taken really 10 working days, but like we said, influx of cases, it's taking a while. So when you get the appeal registered, you get a registration letter, and that sets out the life of the appeal, if you like, and it gives you a deadline for the local authority's response, gives you a deadline for when your final evidence needs to be submitted by, it gives you the local authority a deadline for when they must prepare the bundle, which is all of the papers that have been included as part of this appeal. And that will be like a tool that the panel will use, and that you will use, and advocates and everybody in the tribunal will use as part of the hearing. And then you'll get a final hearing date. Now, paper hearings. What do you think of paper hearings, Adam?
I'm not a big fan.
Adam rolled his eyes. For those of you who can't see him, he rolled his eyes.
So I think the reason why I'm not a big fan of paper hearings is I think in some cases a child's case needs to be explained by giving verbal evidence at a tribunal.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can't really understand the child's needs unless it's explained to you in terms of how their needs impact them on a day-to-day basis. And it may also require, you know, cross-examination of a local authority witness, someone who's turned down the decision to assess, or maybe an educational psychologist used by a local authority in the past to really understand why they're refusing to undertake the needs assessment. Equally, in a case involving a refusal to undertake a needs assessment, whilst the legal threshold is low, in most cases, you are going to probably require up-to-date evidence. So usually, depending on the child's needs, you're looking at instructing independent experts. We go into a lot of detail, as Salisse was saying, in episodes 5 and 7 of our first series of the podcast on the requirements for independent evidence. But those experts that we're talking about, maybe an educational psychologist, you may wish to attend a tribunal to give evidence as well. So cases where I feel kind of very anxious about them going to a tribunal hearing on paper rather than in person might be your high-functioning autistic student who academically is very good but is not attending school or is having real social issues, or your dyslexic student who is very bright but unable to put on paper his views and, I suppose, display to his teachers his abilities. A lot of those types of cases I feel really need to be explained to a panel, and evidence needs to be provided by experts in person. I think it's a much better way of ensuring that the decision that a tribunal makes is correct and hasn't been impacted on, say, the kind of gaps between written evidence and what someone would say verbally at a hearing. I feel like holistically you get a better understanding of a child's needs and what they require by giving verbal evidence and me giving representations and cross-examining witnesses rather than just relying on what's there on the papers.
Of course. And, you know, what sometimes we forget, because if it's up to the local authority, they'll go for a paper hearing every time because they're, you know, short massively on case officers to go to these hearings, and time and resources and all the rest of it. So, you know, it may seem easier sometimes if the local authority is saying, oh, let's just have a paper hearing, and you think, oh, I've got all of my papers, so why not? Like, it just, it saves me half a day, and usually they are half a day refusal to assess cases. But the one thing, one of the things that we can't control in a tribunal is the panel. And the panel, as much as they are unbiased, they're an unbiased, independent panel of professionals. One of them is a qualified judge, so a solicitor or a barrister. And the other one or two, depending on the case, will be specialist panel members, so they will have expertise in the area of CND law. They are individuals, and individuals interpret things differently. And we may want to steer their attention from one thing to another and say, judge, like, we submit respectfully that you should focus on this report, not that report, and these are the reasons why. Whereas if we're not there, or if you're not there, and you know, you can represent yourself in person, the SEND tribunal is a forum where lay members can represent themselves. So if we're not there, or if you're not there, if someone's not there to control that element and say, like, we really want you to focus on this and not that, then they will use their expertise to focus on what they consider to be important. And sometimes, you know, our views are, you know, our views as parents don't come out. So sometimes, you know, a lot of the time, I don't know about you, Adam, but a lot of the times that I've represented at tribunal, especially by experienced judges, one of the first things that they do is they speak to parents. They say, well, mum and dad, you know, how's Johnny? How's he doing? How's he been at home and at school, and etc.? Or explain, I know one particular judge always used to say, well, can you describe a typical day for me in Johnny's life? And they'll say, well, you know, it takes about an hour and a half to get out the front door because of X, Y, Z and these sensitivities, and putting shoes on, and you know, if it's summer, then putting the sun cream on. I know that's quite a common problem a lot with our autistic children. So that voice kind of disappears, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, the way I always look at it is it's very rare when I'm handed a parent's papers that I feel like I really get a true reflection, a pen portrait of that person and their needs and how it impacts on them. It's usually by talking to parents that you really start seeing that. But when you're an evidence-based tribunal, it's not just the parent's voice we need to hear, it's the experts giving their views on need and its impacts on that child. And I don't think that often comes off enough through reports as it is through giving verbal evidence at a tribunal.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are cases where I'd say, very rare, I suppose, where I consider them what we call a slam dunk case, and the authority should concede and the tribunal should make that decision. But I'd never like to leave things to chance. So I'd always want to ensure that the case is heard properly. From a practical point of view as well, if a local authority thinks it's going to a final verbal hearing rather than a written hearing, you tend to find that it focuses their minds. So it can be a very good, I suppose, handmaiden to assessment rather than the authority just waiting on the tribunal to make a decision. So yeah, it might speed up a local authority actually making the right decision.
Yeah, and to say that, you know, we as solicitors have a duty, and it's also in the overriding objective for us to try and settle matters if we possibly can, and work with parties are required to work together to try and resolve all the issues. So that is always our aim throughout the life of the case. It is never our sole aim to get to tribunal. We always try and settle if possible, which sometimes it's not outside of tribunal.
Well, I think that's our aim, but yeah. I'm not always sure it's everyone's aim. And I think you have to look at intentions here. To allow a decision to go all the way to a final hearing from That's a local true. Authority's point of view could be putting off a decision over an EHC plan and
That's
funding
very true.
It.
It's very true. It's a very naive statement of me. See, I believe it's one of the reasons why I wanted to be a lawyer, is for the great good, fighting for the great good.
Well, we all went into becoming lawyers for that reason.
Yeah.
But it doesn't always translate that everyone thinks the same way.
It's true. So that's it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening, as ever.
Thanks, everyone.